Welcome to Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday, and we have two topics today. Later on, we're going to hear about the range of news that's coming from Israel and Palestine today, including a speech from Jared Kushner at the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. That's coming up at the bottom of the hour. But first, we're going to hear about wetlands, the Clean Water Rule, and a legal fight between some states and the feds. We're going to take your calls about both topics. So if you'd like to call in, the number is 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Well, several states are suing the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for putting on hold an Obama-era rule to protect wetlands and waterways. And this month, an organization of wetland scientists filed a brief with the courts in support of the states and the Clean Water Rule of 2015. Professor Royal Gardner is with the Stetson University College of Law. He's the director of the Institute for Biodiversity of Law and Policy. I spoke with him last Thursday. Here's a short interview I did with Professor Royal Gardner talking about the law and the Clean Water Rule.
Back in 2015, the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issued a new rule called the Clean Water Rule, which defined the waters that are protected under the Clean Water Act. Subsequently, with the new administration, they have suspended that rule for 2 years. And so what we are doing is challenging the suspension of the Obama-era Clean Water Rule.
And you're filing a brief that essentially says, look, the suspension didn't follow science. Why is that?
Yeah, that's correct. We have filed an amicus brief on behalf of the Society of Wetland Scientists. And this suspension rule has to go through the normal administrative procedures, which requires the agency to consider comments that have been submitted by members of the public. And in this particular case, the Society of Wetland Scientists and several other scientific societies emphasize the need to consider the scientific record before making any decision in terms of suspending or revoking the Clean Water Rule. The agencies expressly refuse to do that. And so what we are arguing in support of the states in the Southern District of New York is that the suspension rule is arbitrary and capricious because it fails to consider the scientific basis of the Clean Water Rule.
The Attorney General for New York, who I assume is the lead lawyer on this, has just resigned. Is that going to affect it?
No, because the attorneys who actually work on the substance of this and file this are unchanged. And so it's more of the line attorneys who work on this.
So getting back to the Clean Water Rule, how would the Clean Water Rule, if it is implemented, how would that affect biodiversity, for example?
What the Clean Water Rule does is it provides more certainty in terms of what waters are covered. And that, in turn, protects biodiversity because before an industry can discharge pollutants into a particular water, including wetlands, or fill a water in to build something, they need to get a permit from either the EPA or the Corps of Engineers. And so, but the first question is the water protected by the Clean Water Act? And so the Clean Water Rule provides some categorical rules to give some clarity to industry, and thus the Society of Wetland Scientists has written in favor of the rule.
Critics of the Clean Water Rule say that, well, then it would have covered things like drainage ditches and it would have been a burden on landowners, but you disagree.
I do disagree. The Clean Water Rule actually can help landowners because it clarifies whether the waters are covered or not. And in the long run, it helps landowners and society in general because it protects those aquatic resources that ultimately provide us clean drinking water and also help biodiversity as well.
How would Florida be affected if the Clean Water Rule does become enacted versus if it's suspended? How would that affect Florida?
The way that it would affect Florida is that currently the Clean Water Rule is suspended, and the Trump administration would actually like to make it a permanent repeal and then restrict the geographic jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act even further. And if that happened, then basically the Corps of Engineers would not be involved in many permitting decisions within the state of Florida, and so we'd lose that federal protection.
There could be fewer regulations to slow down development?
Yes, that's certainly a possibility. And, you know, as we've seen with recent storm activity in the Gulf and elsewhere, we actually have to take into account where we're building our communities to ensure that they're going to be resilient.
And finally, I should ask, what's the next step in this legal process? Will there be a hearing?
Yes, there will be. So the states have filed a motion for summary judgment, and so the court actually just accepted our amicus brief today. The federal government, the EPA, and the Corps of Engineers will be given an opportunity to reply, and then the court will schedule time for arguments.
Well, that's Royal Gardner, a professor at Stetson University College of Law. I spoke to him last Thursday. He helped write an amicus brief that was filed this month in support of states suing the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for putting on hold an Obama-era rule to protect wetlands and waterways. And as you heard in that interview, the brief is also supported by the Society of Wetland Scientists. And our guest for the rest of this segment is their immediate past president, Jillian Davies. Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, Jillian.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on the show. Well, before we talk about the Clean Water Rule and how it affects wetlands, why don't you begin by talking about your own research on wetlands? What do you do?
Well, I am a wetland scientist, and I actually work in the private sector. I work for a consulting company that offers a wide range of services, such as engineering and survey and natural resources and planning and landscape architecture, and we help people to go through the permitting process for their projects, or we also help government agencies with their work as it relates to wetlands regulations in this context.
Why are wetlands important?
Wetlands are important for a number of reasons. They function in the ecosystems. They provide a disproportionate number of ecosystem services to society and to ecosystems, such as storing floodwaters during severe events and flooding. And then they also retain that water so that later in the year, when there's a dry spell or a drought, they can then provide water to communities and to the ecosystem. And as water passes through them, they act as a filter, and they filter out the toxins and pollutants. They also act as localized cooling areas, which helps during the hot weather. And they buffer coasts from sea level rise and coastal storms. And they offer a lot of habitat for wildlife. They have more biodiversity than a lot of other systems, and they store carbon in their soils and the vegetation, which helps keep carbon out of the atmosphere. So they help to offset the warming climate.
And we heard from Professor Gardner about the Clean Water Rule, but is there anything that you can add about it, about what the Clean Water Rule was when it was put in place by the Obama administration?
Sure. The Clean Water Rule, I think, in essence, used the best available science in conjunction with judicial rulings to come up with a way of managing our water resources so that we can achieve the functional goals of the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act has a really functional definition as to what it's supposed to do. It wants to restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. So that's a very functional definition. And the 2015 Obama-era Clean Water Rule, I think, was very successful at doing that and doing it based on science and in the context of the past judicial history of decisions.
Did it add to the number of types of waterways and types of land with wetlands on them that would be included under the rubric of the Clean Water Act?
Well, from my reading of it, no, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there and misinformation. And in fact, it seems to me that they actually gave a more refined more specific definition of, for instance, tributaries, so that it was actually a little bit less inclusive rather than more inclusive.
But from a scientific standpoint, you're saying it's actually maybe even more accurate?
I think they did a very good job at using the existing science to hone in on those wetlands and waterways that have an ecological contribution to the waters of the United States. And so I think they came up with a very solid functional definition, yes.
Our guest is the past president of the Society of Wetland Scientists, Jillian Davies. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. If you'd like to join this conversation, the number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email dj at wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And Jillian, I should ask you, so the Trump administration is trying to put the Clean Water Rule on pause. Well, it has temporarily suspended it, and it wants to put it on, permanently repeal it, as Professor Gardner said. And you've been assisting the states in suing the Army Corps and the EPA to stop that process. Why is that?
Well, we strongly feel that the scientific body of evidence supports the 2015 Clean Water Rule, which went through an extensive public comment process, over 200 days of comments with over 400 public meetings and over a million comments. And they used what they call the connectivity report, which was a summary of about 1,200 peer-reviewed scientific publications to come up with their conclusions. And the result was something that is very much supported by the best available science as well as the judicial context. And this new proposed rule is not supported by science. And so it's not going to protect and maintain and restore the chemical, physical, biological integrity of the nation's waters. And that's going to affect all of us, because we all want clean water. We all have seen and understand the consequences of what happens when our water supply gets polluted. And if the wetlands that contribute to having a clean water supply are filled or polluted, then all of that pollution can travel downstream to our water supplies, as well as we have, if we reduce the existing wetlands on the landscape, that will displace floodwaters into our backyards, our basements, our infrastructure. And so there are a variety of ways where this will directly impact us. And then it will also increase our costs as a society, because if we don't have our natural systems cleaning water for us for free, then we have to pay for more infrastructure to clean the water ourselves in a water treatment plant or something of that nature. And we have to build infrastructure to manage flooding rather than having the floodwater stored for free in a wetland.
We've talked about how the Clean Water Rule, the goal of it, the purpose of it, is to protect the nation's waterways. So what is the status of water in the country right now? I mean, I imagine there's a range, but there's some pollution. How is that? Has it been improving or what?
I think it. Our efforts with the pre-existing protections for wetlands and waters have definitely slowed the deterioration of our waters, but our waters are still, we see it's really variable. We see some waters where the water quality level has improved significantly because of the efforts, but then we have other areas that are continuing to be degraded. So it's a bit of a patchwork, I'd say, in that regard.
And a few minutes ago, you talked about how having healthy wetlands protects or is a cost savings in the sense of not having to manage flood and floodwaters and so forth. And my understanding is that the New York University Law School is filing an amicus brief about for this lawsuit about the economic damage of pausing this clean water rule. Are there other types of economic damages that can be prevented, rather, if the clean water rule is reinstated?
Yes, I think that there's a lot of recent research and studies have been published documenting the economic value of protecting and maintaining and restoring our wetlands, such as a recent study by Narayan et al. They looked at the areas hit by Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast and found that wetlands prevented $625 million worth of damages to some of those coastal communities, and that on an annual basis in Ocean County, New Jersey, towns that wetlands prevented about 20% of those losses due to storm damage. So people are out there actually quantifying this, and the insurance industry has gotten very interested. I know there's one insurance company who's recently partnered with the Nature Conservancy to restore coastal wetlands as a way of reducing risks that then the insurance company winds up footing the bill for.
And I'm not sure how familiar you are with Florida wetlands and waterways, but here in Florida, we have problems with when Lake Okeechobee becomes polluted. It's this giant lake in the south of the state, and then it flows into the canals and rivers that go east and west, and then that pollution will affect coastal communities on the Gulf Coast and on the Atlantic Coast. So what would you say to Floridians? Why should Floridians care about protecting clean water?
Lots of reasons. Same as for all of us, we all want clean water. And an added reason for Florida is your coastal location, in that if you maintain both clean water and just the water volume, or if you're able to store water in the upland, in the landscape, that stored water, fresh water, supports the groundwater table of freshwater, and that helps to, with sea level rise, there's going to be increased, and with development, increased encroachment of saline water from the ocean, and some communities may already be experiencing that. And so if you maintain your base of freshwater, that's going to help hold that intrusion of the salt water into the groundwater supplies at bay.
Well, those are my only questions. Is there anything else that our listeners should know about the clean water rule or about wetlands?
Well, I think one way to think about wetlands is, and the need to protect some of the smaller wetlands that are higher in the watershed, such as intermittent streams and things that may appear in and of themselves to be small, is that they're a network and they work collectively to support the larger flows downstream, similar to the way that capillaries in our body reach the far reaches of our muscles and different parts of our bodies, but they support the larger flows in the larger veins and arteries. And if you were to introduce pollutants or block the capillaries all over our body, you pretty soon become a very unhealthy person, and that's kind of a good analogy. If we were to allow widespread pollution of those smaller wetland and waterway features, we will all soon see and experience bigger loss of ecological health and function further downstream.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on WMNF's Midpoint today, Jillian.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Thanks so much. Jillian Davies is the past president of the Society of Wetland Scientists, and we'll be right back after this quick music break. We will head to Israel and Palestine and find out all the huge news that's happening there. Stay with us. Well, if you missed any of that interview, it'll be up on our website later today, wmnf.org/news. And that was some Bob Marley music. We turn now to the provocative opening of the U.S. Embassy in Israel, in Jerusalem, the peaceful protests in the Gaza Strip, and the deadly response by the Israeli military. There have been they've killed dozens of people today. They've wounded hundreds. In a minute, we're going to hear a short taped speech given by President Donald Trump. And I want to hear what you have to say about this speech by Donald Trump, and also a speech from Jerusalem, from the opening of the Jerusalem Embassy, by his son-in-law and senior White House advisor Jared Kushner. We don't hear from him that much, so I thought it was interesting that he spoke today, and he said a lot of provocative things, especially if you were watching this video from the U.S. Embassy at the same time you were watching the video that was being taken in the Gaza Strip today. So I want to hear your thoughts on all these things. First, here's some of the latest news. Let me read a little bit about from the AP about what is happening today. Israeli soldiers shot and killed at least 43 Palestinians during mass protests along the Gaza border today. It was the deadliest day there since a devastating 2014 cross-border war and it cast a shadow over Israel's festive inauguration today of the new U.S. embassy in contested Jerusalem. At least 772 protesters were wounded, including 86 of them who were in serious or critical condition. Well, that's just a little bit. I might read a little bit more of what's going on, of what the news is today. I'll read that as we go throughout the program. But I definitely want to hear your thoughts on the U.S. opening the embassy in Jerusalem. They did it on the 70th anniversary of the founding of Israel, which is celebrated in Israel. Palestinians call it the Nakba, which is the catastrophe. It's when they were driven out of their homes. In fact, the U.S. Embassy, I was reading on Twitter earlier, someone tweeted the name of the family, the Palestinian family, whose land that used to be before now the U.S. Embassy is there in Jerusalem. So I do want to hear from you, 813-239-9663. You can email DJ at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And I want to first bring you a very short taped speech from President Trump. He did not go to Jerusalem today. Rick Scott was there. Governor Rick Scott was there. He was thanked a couple of times from the stage. But Donald Trump sent a video message, and here is a couple of minutes of what he had to say.
Exactly 70 years ago, the United States, under President Harry Truman, became the first nation to recognize the State of Israel. Today, we officially open the United States Embassy in Jerusalem. Congratulations. It's been a long time coming. Almost immediately after declaring statehood in 1948, Israel designated the city of Jerusalem as its capital. The capital the Jewish people established in ancient times. So important. Today, Jerusalem is the seat of Israel's government. It is the home of the Israeli legislature and the Israeli Supreme Court and Israel's prime minister and president. Israel is a sovereign nation with the right, like every other sovereign nation, to determine its own capital. Yet for many years, we failed to acknowledge the obvious, the plain reality that Israel's capital is Jerusalem. On December 6, 2017, at my direction, the United States finally and officially recognized Jerusalem as the true capital of Israel. Today, we follow through on this recognition and open our embassy in the historic and sacred land of Jerusalem. And we're opening it many, many years ahead of schedule. As I said in December, our greatest hope is for peace. The United States remains fully committed to facilitating a lasting peace agreement, and we continue to support the status quo at Jerusalem's holy sites, including at the Temple Mount, also known as Haram al-Sharif. This city and its entire nation is a testament to the unbreakable spirit of the Jewish people. The United States will always be a great friend of Israel and a partner in the cause of freedom and peace. We wish Ambassador Friedman good luck as he takes up his office in this beautiful Jerusalem embassy, and we extend a hand in friendship to Israel the Palestinians, and to all of their neighbors. May there be peace. May God bless this embassy. May God bless all who serve there. And may God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
Well, that's President Donald Trump speaking on tape. It was a video message that was broadcast during this presentation of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem this morning. And what do you think about that? What do you think about what President Trump says? And I'm going to ask this question again in a few minutes after I play you what Jared Kushner said, because I think what he says is even more provocative. 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Why don't we go to the phones right now and hear from Brian in Sarasota. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Am I on the line?
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I think that was a disastrous move. If anything, Jerusalem should have been an international city. It's actually divided into four parts between the four different religions. When Israel was formed, everyone realized that it was Tel Aviv. All they're doing is just exasperating the problems in the Middle East. Just to have you know, my grandson is in Shabbat right now. He's only a year and a half. But I think all those desert religions are all crazy myself.
All right, Brian, thanks for those thoughts. I'm going to drop you off because you have a buzz on your line, but thank you for calling in and breaking the ice. If you have some thoughts, 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Let me read an email that came in from Adam. He writes, Israel is a terrorist state. Can you imagine if a U.S. military was randomly killing Mexicans who got close to the border? We would be outraged. We support terrorism against Palestinians by funding Israel. It's appalling the mainstream media isn't covering this every single day. Those are comments from Adam out there in cyberspace. Do you disagree with Adam? Give us a call, 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Whether you disagree with Adam or if you agree or if you have some other thoughts, what do you think? Is this going to make, you know, kind of regardless of what your position is, is this going to make peace in the Middle East? I guess that's a cliche, I guess, but you know what I'm trying to say is peace going to be easier with this opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem? A lot of the people who spoke during the presentation, Benjamin Netanyahu and a lot of the other people who spoke, the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to the to Israel, a lot of them talked about peace and that this was, you know, going to bring peace for Israelis and so on. Will peace be easier with this embassy opening? What's your thoughts? 813-239-9663. We will hear from Jared Kushner in just a moment. Also, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Let's put Howard in St. Pete on the line. Hi, Howard.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to say?
Oh, you know, the little Trump excerpt that you just played, it made me angry. It's like, what made us the world police? And it's not our business to be getting into their business. Leave them alone. Let them figure it out. And let's figure out our own country.
You know,
but he's so busy. He's so busy, like, getting into everybody else's business.
So part of what Trump was saying was that, you know, that let them decide for themselves, let Israel decide for themselves. So kind of what you're saying is Trump is kind of enabling Israel to decide where its embassy is going to be, where the U.S. embassy is going to be in Israel.
Yeah, things just have seemed to be getting like worse and worse, and it's scaring me, actually.
All right. Thank you, Howard.
Anyways, great show, and you know, thank you for being there.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it. Thanks. I hope it's just that line that has the buzz. Let's try an experiment. We'll go to a different line and we'll hear from Gina in Tampa. Hi, Gina.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, and you sound really well, so that's that makes me happy. So go ahead, please.
I just wanted to say I was trying to find Jared Kushner's remarks, but really, I mean, even without hearing him, I can't imagine how anybody could talk about, I read where he said something about this is the path to peace. How does one consider this to be a gesture that's all-inclusive when, first of all, they've got a pastor there who is called Muslims just about, I mean, every evil name you can think of, that number one, that is alienating to the Muslim world, and they've got to be a part of any peace process, all of them, especially the Palestinians. And then doing something that's so partisan, like moving the capital. I don't think that that in and of itself should be a barrier to peace, but I think the symbolism of it. I don't think that Donald Trump is really a peacemaker anyway. Just my opinion. I think that what his actions are antagonistic, if anything. And I think we're going to see more turmoil. I don't necessarily blame Israel for wanting to defend itself. I mean, it's surrounded by hostile people, but I think things are just going to get worse, unfortunately. So I'm looking forward to you having Jared Kushner's comments. What I've heard so far, he's just making some superficial remarks, and I don't know why, you know, well, I know why he's a son-in-law, you know, to send him to Israel, but really, Jared Kushner, does anybody really care what he has to say?
Well, I hope you do. I hope you, I mean, I know you're saying that in a different context than what I'm...
I don't mean that in a way that we don't care. I mean, yeah, I think he's just going to...
I think you'll find it interesting. I think especially if you can kind of, in your mind, picture the juxtaposition of something that was happening about 35 miles away or 25 miles away or whatever it was on or maybe it's more than that, 45, something like that, on the border of Gaza.
The death of the Palestinians. The death toll is increasing. It's increasing. And yeah, he's there making all these little happy, shallow remarks. But yeah, I hear you. I get it. I'm only seeing what I see in the paper right now. But when you play the remarks, it'd be real interesting to hear what he had to say. But anyway.
I will get to those. I want to have you hang on for just a second, Gina. Okay. I don't mean to monopolize you and ignore the other people on the line, but I'm getting this email that says, it's from the area code 727. It's someone who's afraid to sign their name, I guess. And this person asks, provocative, ? Because I called the opening of the embassy provocative. And this person's challenging me on that. And this person is saying, provocative, it's about time we put our embassy in Jerusalem where it belongs. Trump is the only one that had the courage to move forward. It's terrific. Do you even know what provocative means? Not all of your listeners are liberals. Kudos to Trump. And so here's the reason why I use the word provocative, because it is provoking a response.
It is provocative. That's not a bad terminology for it. I know you didn't mean it you meant it in a true sense of what provocative means. I would agree that it is provocative. I think that it's just symbolic, but for the symbolism in that area, what it's saying is that we're partisans, and we can't do that if we're going to really be true peacemakers. We have to say that, you know, a two-state solution is something we embrace. How does that, you know, having moving the capital to Jerusalem, how does that really say that we're embracing that? And obviously, you know, taking sides, I think that we're doing that. I think that you're right on calling it provocative. Not only that, but I think even more damaging is the pastor, and I'm sorry I can't recall his name offhand, but I did listen to some of his comments. I mean, talk about vitriol against the Muslims, against everybody. They hate everybody. But why in the world would anybody, you know, get someone like that to make remarks at something that you would consider a very, very important event? I mean, that just, I mean, to anybody, you know, spewing hatred like that doesn't set the tone well.
And it was,
and death toll is rising. I'm going to go. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that call, Gina. And I'm really glad that Rob had that show on just a half an hour before mine about who these two pastors are and what their role was in today's ceremony. I thought that was a really great it was great that, that Rob had those guests on. And it was interesting, one of the preachers, when he was done speaking, you know, saying a prayer, I guess it was, at the end he says, amen. And, you know, in often you're used to hearing the whole crowd say amen, but I think that there were a lot, it seemed to be that hardly anyone responded when he said that. And I wonder if there were, like, the Israelis there were uncomfortable with that person being there. I, you know, this is just speculation from me watching a video and not seeing every face that was there and just trying to guess what the mood was. But I think there might have been people there that were uncomfortable with at least one of those two speakers that Rob was talking about on his last show. Well, you're listening to Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. It's 12:42 in the afternoon. Coming up next is executive session. We are going to hear Jared Kushner's speech at the opening of the U.S. Embassy right now. I have two people hanging on the line, Bob and Matt. Hang on for a second. I do want to play this speech. I want to make sure we get it in. And if you would like to comment on what you're about to hear, 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Here's the son-in-law of the President of the United States, Jared Kushner. He's speaking at the opening of the new U.S. Embassy to Israel in Jerusalem, speaking today.
And I am especially honored to be here today as a representative of the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. I also want to thank Prime Minister Netanyahu and Sarah for being with us here today to celebrate this historic occasion. Thank you very much. I'd like to ask all of the members of Congress who are here on their delegations to rise and be recognized. Today would not be possible without your advocacy throughout the years. Thank you, Deputy Secretary Sullivan, for leading our delegation, Secretary Mnuchin, for your leadership and for your friendship, and of course, Ivanka, thank you for all the great work you do to help so many people in our country and throughout the world, including me, so I love you. I also want to acknowledge Vice President Mike Pence for his tireless efforts to strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship. In December of last year, President Trump announced to the world that the United States would finally recognize the truth, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. He also declared that we would soon move our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and just 5 months later, we are standing on these grounds. While presidents before him have backed down from their pledge to move the American embassy once in office, this president delivered. Because when President Trump makes a promise, he keeps it. But today also demonstrates American leadership. By moving our embassy to Jerusalem, we have shown the world once again that the United States can be trusted. We stand with our friends and our allies. And above all else, we've shown that the United States of America will do what's right, and so we have. Israel's a sovereign nation with the right to determine its own capital, the same right that is enjoyed by every other country in the world. In taking this action, the United States has also chosen to strengthen the bond between our two countries. Our special bond is the envy of nations throughout the world. This bond is forged through shared history, sustained through shared interests, and immortalized through shared principles. The United States stands with Israel because we both believe in freedom. We stand together because we both believe in human rights. We stand together because we believe democracy is worth defending. And the United States stands with Israel because we believe we know that it is the right thing to do.
Thank you.
When we stand together for the principles and the values we share, we shine a light of justice unto the world. Israel proves every day the boundless power of freedom. This land is the only land in the Middle East in which Jews, Muslims, and Christians, and people of all faiths participate and worship freely according to their beliefs. Israel protects women's rights, freedom of speech, and the right of every individual to reach their God-given potential. These are the same values that the United States cherishes. These are the values that bind us together. These are also the values that have made Israel one of the most vibrant nations in the world. This tiny population has spurred advancements in technology, medicine, and agriculture, making the world a healthier, safer, and more prosperous place. These are the blessings we hope Israel can one day share with its neighbors. Last week, President Trump acknowledged another truth and kept another promise. He announced his intention to exit the dangerous, flawed, and one-sided Iran deal. Iran's aggression threatens the many peace-loving citizens throughout the region and the entire world. From Israel to Jordan to Egypt to Saudi Arabia and beyond, many leaders are fighting to modernize their countries and create better lives for their people. In confronting common threats and in pursuit of common interests, previously unimaginable opportunities and alliances are emerging. I am also proud to be here today as a member of the team that President Trump has entrusted to lead the efforts to bring peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It has been an honor to work with our new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, National Security Advisor John Bolton, our Ambassador David Friedman, and our special representative, Jason Greenblatt, who really does so much great work. I also want to acknowledge Ambassador Nikki Haley, who really has created a new day for Israel at the UN. On December 6th, President Trump was very clear that his decision and today's celebration do not reflect a departure from our strong commitment to lasting peace, a peace that overcomes the conflicts of the past in order to give our children a brighter and more boundless future. As we have seen from the protests of the last month and even today, those provoking violence are part of the problem and not part of the solution. The United States is prepared to support a peace agreement in every way that we can. We believe that it is possible for both sides to gain more than they give so that all people can live in peace, safe from danger, free from fear, and able to pursue their dreams. The United States recognizes the sensitivity surrounding Jerusalem, a city that means so much to so many. Jerusalem is a city unique in the history of civilization. No other place on earth can claim significance to three major religions. Each day, Jews pray at the Western Wall, Muslims bow in prayer at Al-Aqsa Mosque, and Christians worship at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That is why President Trump has called many times, including right now, on all parties to maintain the status quo at Jerusalem's holy sites, including the Temple Mount, also known as Haram al-Sharif. While the challenges to peace are numerous, I have personally seen that the determination of the leaders in the region and throughout the world remains steadfast. They have seen too much pain, sorrow, and wasted opportunity, and they think it's time to try something better. Throughout history, Jerusalem has been the victim of war and conquest. It has been used to divide people and to instigate conflict by those with evil intentions, but it does not have to be this way. Jerusalem must remain a city that brings people of all faiths together to visit, to worship, to respect each other, and to appreciate the majesty of history and the glory of God's creation. Israel has been a responsible custodian of Jerusalem and has kept these religious sites open to all. In fact, immediately after the 1967 war, one of the first acts of the Knesset was to adopt the Protection of Holy Places Law, ensuring access to places of worship to members of all religions. Funds were immediately allocated to repair any damage to the churches, mosques, and synagogues that suffered through war, conflict, and neglect. As Israel turns 70, the search for a lasting peace turns over a new leaf, one of realism and of not being afraid to stand strongly with our allies for what is good, for what is right, and for what is true. When there is peace in this region, we will look back upon this day and remember that the journey to peace started with a strong America recognizing the truth. The pursuit of peace is the noblest pursuit of humankind. I believe peace is within reach if we dare to believe that the future can be different from the past, that we are not condemned to relive history, and that the way things were is not how they must forever be. It will not be an easy road, and it will be filled with difficult moments and tough decisions, but if we dream big, if we lead with courage, we can change the trajectory for millions from hopeless to boundless. This is a hope that many of us know personally. I am here today as a proud American and the grandson of Holocaust survivors. During World War II, my late grandparents, Ray and Joseph Kushner, fled their homes to the forests of Belarus to escape Nazi persecution. Somehow, they managed to resist the horrors and survive. After the war, they built a new life in America, a beacon of hope, a land of limitless opportunity. In my office in the White House, I keep a photo of them on my desk to remind me of how high the stakes are when nations fail to recognize right from wrong and the decisive power America has to tip the scales in favor of the righteous. Today, we take another historic step in that direction. I am confident that as a result, our nations will be stronger, our peoples more prosperous, and our futures filled with even greater promise for peace. May God bless you. May God bless Israel. May God bless the United States of America.
Bless Jared Kushner speaking today in Jerusalem at the opening of the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. It has been moved from Tel Aviv. He's the son-in-law of President Donald Trump. He's senior White House advisor, Jared Kushner. And I want to hear what you have to say, 813-239-9663. You can email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. Let's go to the phones and Matt in Odessa. Thanks for holding.
Hey.
Hi.
Yeah, I was listening to that speech. It was pretty moving, and he did have a lot of facts in there, which are very nice. But it comes down to the point, is the strong preying on the weak? And Israel is the strong, and it preys on the weak. Just like every other country, it has the ability to prey on the weak. And the government should be there to protect the weak from the strong. And instead, it does the bidding of the big donors. It does the bidding of profit, corporations, whatever is needed. They pay the big money, so they dance to that tune. And it's the same thing going on right now in Israel. The big donors want the nationalist, that lizard brain, to get as much as you can, hold as much power as you can, don't compromise, don't make peace. The strong just is going to continue preying on the weak.
Let me address your point about the big donors, because that reminded me that during the ceremony, I saw the photo of this couple, and before the ceremony, a journalist tweeted out the chairs with their names on it. It said, this front row seat reserved for Sheldon Adelson and his wife. And I sent out a tweet that said something like, wow, it costs a lot of money to get front row seats at the embassy, because Sheldon Adelson has donated millions and millions and millions of dollars to candidates and to a party and to PACs not just for this day, but essentially, you know, you can think about it as those millions of dollars for this day, for moving his one of his huge pet projects, I guess, was getting the U.S. to move its embassy to Jerusalem. So that's to your point about political donations.
Bingo. And the leaders of the past, say Thomas and Jefferson, who did what was right, instead of doing what was the most able to keep power and keep profit in their grasp or in their party's grasp, are gone. Now it's purely, where's the money? Where's the power? Screw what's right. I'm going to do what I want to do, and I'm not going to be idealistic and do the right of mankind for the greater good. And I think a majority of Israel, I used to live in Israel, and a majority of Israelis are willing to swap land for peace. But, you know, there's no power in that. There's no profit in that. And so they're easily steamrolled by the other side.
All right, I'm going to move on. Thank you for calling, Matt. I appreciate that call. Let's go to Bob in Tampa. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I disagree with a lot, but, I listen to comments, and first of all, I'm not going to call like a lot of callers and pretend that I have the answer to peace in the Middle East, that hasn't happened in years. These people should all work for the government. It's truth. I've always had the thought that, you can't solve any problem until you know where everybody stands and this is it. They want the embassy there. I don't think it claims Jerusalem for any one particular religious group. It's sacred to a lot of people, but it sets the tone. And so far, I think his foreign policy, he's trying to exert, a little strength, not this wishy-washy, let's just get a deal so I can have some legacy, or, let's make the right deals. Iran didn't stop doing anything. They're create havoc everywhere.
Stopped trying to produce a nuclear weapon?
No, I don't.
They took
that money they got and used it to create trouble. But I don't even want to get into that. Iran hasn't, come on. Iran is not a good player. But anyways, my point is they read too much in power. One thing that struck me is when he spoke about, money and power and political donations. And it's like, let's not forget, the Democrats get political donations too. So who's donating to whatever special interest for them? It works both ways. I'm not going to get into semantics because it just creates arguments and we're too much into that. We're not trying to solve problems anymore. We're picking sides all the time.
All right, Bob, thanks for weighing in. I'm sorry.
Can I say, the Democrats used, 13-14 million to create some, so-called some dossier. I mean, this is what they do with money. So,
Bob, I got to move on. We are done with the show. Thank you for bringing up the dossier. And I want to thank everyone who called. There's sorry about the people on the line that I did not get to. I appreciate that you called in, and I'm sorry I didn't get to you. If you want to leave a voicemail, 813-238-8001, extension 114. You leave a voicemail at that number, and I'll play it next show. 813-238-8001, extension 114. There's about 10 emails I didn't get to. I apologize. I'll talk to you after the show. I want to thank everyone who called, emailed, and texted.